Let me invite you this morning to turn the Old Testament to the book of Ruth. And in just a moment, we will begin a study from that great, though brief, Old Testament book. We're glad to have every visitor. I think we've made considerable contribution to visitors in other places today. And we miss those who are away and pray for their safe return. Let me mention something that I didn't have time to tell the one who made the announcements this morning, because I just got the information. That is that Colleen Smeedy's, Tweedy's, I'll get this right, I've got two names in my mind this morning. Colleen Tweedy's mother, who was injured in an accident, severely injured in New York State, passed away, age 50. And you know that the letters that some of you have already written to Colleen, who is a lonely, solitary Christian in upstate New York, far away from other disciples, that this will be a time of great sorrow for her. So if we don't have that information on the bulletin board, we'll have it there soon enough. Some of you have already gotten her address and have written to her before. And as well, I would mention, Casey Dent tells me that Sarah Smeeter, who was here as late as last Sunday, friends of the Dents, Mark and Sarah, suffered a miscarriage and then had to be in the hospital, and she's had to go back in the hospital, and she's still in Baptist East. So I'm sure that that couple would appreciate your continued interest. The book of Ruth is remarkable for one obvious reason, and that is it is one of two books in the whole of the Bible, 66 books, that is named for a woman. The other is Esther, and they represent, in some measure, a contrast, in that in the case of the book of Esther, it is a Jewish girl who lives among Gentiles and becomes the wife of a Persian king. In the case of Ruth, it is a Gentile girl who comes to live among Jews and becomes the wife of a great Jewish king's ancestor. These are both remarkable women. Mordecai asked of Esther, "Who knows but for this cause you were brought to the kingdom?" And the same question is implicit in the story of Ruth. If you don't know this story, it really is remarkable as literature. In fact, it is reported that Benjamin Franklin, that is the American politician and diplomat Benjamin Franklin, while being entertained by some English ladies with stories of pastoral idols that they enjoyed and appreciated, poems that came out of the pastoral scene, and they were talking about the various authors and the various works that had been done, and Franklin said, "I have one that I'd like to tell you." And so with some of the details left out, he told the story of Ruth, and they were amazed by it, and said, "Where did you get that?" He said, "It's in the Bible." Things that are in the Bible become prosaic to us, commonplace, ordinary, and that ought never to happen. Not simply because this is the Word of God, especially because it is the Word of God, but because this is tremendous, powerful literature that should be respected and read for its value at that level, so that people can come to understand the power of it as a part of the revelation of the mind and heart of God. Why was this book written? It is the story of a Jewish family who lived in Bethlehem, who, because of a famine that came to the region, to the whole land, moved across the Jordan River into Moab, about 40 or perhaps the most 60 miles. Bethlehem is a city about 6 miles south of Jerusalem, which lies upon a gray ridge of mountains just east of the central range. And below it, you can see the places where flocks are still shepherded. And it is surrounded north, east, and south by pasture land. was always known by the and fields. In fact, the name Bethlehem means house of bread. And the grain fields that were there from time immemorial gave it that name. It was the place where there was food. And it was striking that the house of bread should become breadless, that famine should strike so deeply that a farmer would have to leave that region just to escape from his animals being completely ravaged and his family going without food into a region that would have been in many ways despicable to the Jew. Moab was the son of Lot, born to him by the incestuous relationship while he was drunk with his daughters, as well as Ben-Ammi, who became the father of the Ammonites, and Moab became the father of the Moabites. And they were especially despised by the Jews because they had rejected their passage when they came out of Egypt into the Promised Land. They had given them no welcome whatsoever. In fact, so much is this true that it's enshrined in the Scripture. I believe it's 23rd chapter of Deuteronomy, if I'm mistaken. You'll forgive me, I know. Where it is said that a Moabite was not to be accepted in the assembly of Israel until the 10th generation. And so also those who were illegitimately born. Not until the 10th generation could their descendants come into the assembly of Israel. And so they went across the Jordan into Moab. And there they found sustenance. And it is Elimelech, whose name means "My God is King." And Naomi, his wife, whose name means pleasantness or comfort. And their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And there they live for a brief time, and suddenly the father, Elimelech, dies. And then the two sons, who seem to be resigned to staying in Moab, and there is evidence from the book that there has been no relief from the famine at home. And so they take wives of Moabite girls. Been a lot of discussion of this book as to whether or not Elimelech and Naomi made a spiritual blunder when they took this family over into Moab. Why would they do that? Knowing that in that land they worshiped the god Chemosh and other false pagan deities, and that there was an immorality that was true of them that would have put awful pressure upon the family. I'm not sure about that. I'll tell you this, that Elimelech could have gone back in the book of Genesis with which he was familiar and found at least two precedents where Abraham, leaving this very land, had gone first to Egypt and then into the land of Gerar in order to escape famine. And when a father sees that his family is going to need bread and that things have become severe, and I'm sure no Jewish man would leave this region, this land which was their ancient homeland, and particularly Bethlehem, where the indication is that they had and their family has been there for years, and go into a strange place, not only a strange place, but a place where God would not be worshipped. But Abraham had done that. And I'm not sure that we need to be severely critical of Elimelech. Things did not turn out well. But Elimelech might have died if he had stayed in Bethlehem. I'm not sure. There are some who have implied by what they have said in connection with this book that perhaps he was punished in that way. And that Naomi was punished in that way. But that's all speculation. And I would have to say speculation with which I do not feel great harmony. And then 10 years pass. The boys marry. One of the girls' name is Ruth. And then the boys die. And this seems a compounding of tragedy. They left to go and find bread, and all they found was a grave for the father and the two sons. It's uncommon that all three of male members of a family should perish within a period like this. And Naomi is left empty. She is crushed. And then she learns that there is a return to prosperity in Bethlehem, and finding that all she has in this land is three graves, she proposes to leave. and her two daughters go with her. When she gets back home to Bethlehem, she said, "Don't call me Naomi anymore," to the women who came out to meet her. "Don't call me Naomi anymore. Don't call me blessedness. Don't call me comfort. Call me Mara, for God has dealt with me bitterly." I want to say that Naomi at this particular juncture is not feeling too positive about what God has done to her. And we've all been there if we face the facts about our reacting to life circumstances and what we feel about God in the midst of that. We've asked God some hard questions. We've been like Job at times. Why would God put me in this position? I'm not sure that Naomi ever says, though someone suggested that she does, that it's my fault that I got in this trouble. I should never have gone to Moab. We should never have gone over there. It was a mistake. I don't get the impression that Naomi says this. She seems to be blaming God with her tragedy and calling herself bitterness now. I don't know if you are in that position now, but you need to realize, as this book, I think, dramatically declares, that God cares for those who trust Him. And it doesn't make any difference how emptily you may find your circumstance, you may find yourself moving. He can fill up the emptiness. But there's a poem by Antoinette Wilson that may speak to this. "Are you standing at wit's end corner, Christian with troubled brow? Are you thinking of what is before you and all you are bearing now? Does all the world seem against you and you in the battle alone? Remember, at wit's end corner is just where God's power is shown." Are you standing at wit's end corner, blinded with wearing pain, feeling you cannot endure it? You cannot bear the strain, bruised with the constant buffeting, dizzy and dazed and numb. Remember, at wit's end corner is where Jesus loves to come. Are you standing at wit's end corner, your work before you spread, all lying begun, unfinished, and pressing on heart and head, longing for strength to do it, stretching out trembling hands? Remember, at wit's end corner, the burden bearer stands. Are you standing at wit's end corner? Then you're just in the very spot to learn the wondrous resources of Him who does not fail. No doubt to a brighter pathway your footsteps will soon be moved, but only at wit's end corner is the God who is able proved. Naomi is in the background of the story. She's a woman of considerable strength, wonderful woman. She taught her sons. They obviously were fine young men. And that's reflected in how these two young Moabites reacted to her departure. They said, "We're going to go with you." They had nothing in Bethlehem. A widowed mother-in-law. No provision there. Mothers and fathers still alive, likely. In fact, their mothers are referred to in Moab. And here they are widows, and there's no social security, and the only possibility of care will be in your father's house. And they can look easy enough at Naomi and see she doesn't have anything. She's as empty as she can be in terms of any kind of resource. Her husband dead, her sons are dead. If you're an older widow, then the only hope you'd ever have of being cared for was with your children, and she doesn't have any. And so they can see the emptiness of that prospect, and yet they are determined to go with her. She has created such love for her in them because of the relationship they have had that they are willing to go and risk whatever is ahead of them. Whether Naomi is just testing these girls when she says to them, "Go back. Think of what you're doing here. Go back home." And the interesting thing and the shocking thing is that she says about Orpah that she went back to her people and to her gods. When we ask the question, would Naomi, who is a believer in and a servant of Jehovah, would she ever say to anyone she loved, go back to your gods, to the false gods of Moab? It's a little difficult for me to believe that's what she's saying. It's easier for me to believe that she's simply testing the loyalty and the determination of these young girls because she knows it's going to be difficult. And they need to understand just exactly what's ahead of them. Perhaps in some measure it's like Jesus saying to the man who said, I will follow you wherever you go. Well, remember this. Foxes have holes and the birds of heaven have nests, but I don't have a place to lay my head. Think about that before you say what you say. Well, after she had urged them to go back in the first chapter of Ruth, told them that there were no sons in her womb, and even if she had some today, that it would be too late to provide husbands for these girls. I have nothing for you, she said. Think again of the choice you're making. And Orpah comes and kisses her, but it's a kiss of farewell. But Ruth clings to her and will not leave. And it's because of that scene that we have the most memorable words from the book of Ruth, and perhaps in many ways some of the most memorable words of the Old Testament. Words are often repeated in marriage ceremonies, but they are not words spoken between a young man and a young lady. They are words spoken by a young lady to an older woman. Verse 16 of the first chapter, and Ruth said, do not entreat me to leave you and to return from following after you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge, and your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me more and more also, if aught but death parts you and me. Wonderful words. These are the words of commitment. They are the words of resolve. They are the words of love's resolve. Was it because of her love for Naomi? Yes, it was that. But it's obvious that Ruth has seen something of Jehovah, come to understand the greatness of this God, who is a God not just in the land of Canaan, but who's the God who rules over Moab and every other place on earth. And she recognizes that it's important for her to come to know him. I suspect that part of it is the gentleness and the kindness and the love that was shown in this family. She saw something in them that she had not seen in her homeland, not in her own family, not among her own people. But whatever the case, it's an act of absolute trust. Again, I say to every young man, when a woman says to you, I will go wherever you go, and wherever you stay, that's where I'm going to stay, and wherever you die, that's where I'm going to die, and there will I be buried. That is a tremendous commitment that should be cherished. But it's the kind of commitment that can be made between two men or between two women in the sense of loyalty and commitment to serve and to care for and to do good to other people. It's the kind of commitment at last that we must make to God. It reflects that. But it's a woman who said it. And I think it's an expression, and that Ruth is an expression of what is especially true of women, and that is their ability and their inclination to be absolutely loyal, to make a commitment and to fulfill it, even though it often is difficult. Wonderful words. Love's request, some have described it. And so she went with Naomi to Bethlehem and to nothing. And when they got there, everybody was glad to see them. The women of the city came out to meet them and to welcome them home, and then they found out that Naomi didn't have anything. Husband dead, sons dead. The only thing left is this Moabite daughter-in-law. And they left them alone, evidently, after that. That was unimpressive. Wholly unimpressive. It's April or May of the year, the time of the barley harvest. Providential, I should hope. They're not going to go hungry because the barley is just being harvested. And the second chapter is the story of Ruth saying to Naomi, you let me go and I'll get what I can in the barley harvest. You know the law of Israel. You know the law of Moses said that those who had fields were not to reap the corners of the field. They were to be left to the poor. And not only that, the grain that was dropped by the harvesters was not to be picked up, was not to be gathered up, but to be left also for the poor so that they could glean in the fields and take what was left. And so Ruth says, I need to go. We've got to have something to eat, and I'm ready to go. This is a young lady of resolve, and she sees the need that exists, and she acts upon it and goes into the field. And it just happens that it's the field of Boaz, who is a relative of Elimelech. Interesting exchange here between Ruth and this older man. We know that he's an older man, and I say by that older, I mean middle age. Because he says to her later that she has done well and that she has not gone after the young men, rich or poor. So that tells us that he's not in the category of the youth. He's not a young man. And he's a wealthy man. Now, that expression is used in the Old Testament to speak about a certain man, and it's translated there, man of valor. It may mean more than just that he had something. It means that he was a man of some character, some integrity. And I think you'll see that. Ruth is a woman of tremendous integrity, of loyalty and love to a woman against her own best interest. She acts because she cares and because she's been impressed with the greatness of God. And then she comes to take up her task here, and it's obvious that she's going to have to carry the load because Naomi can't do it and no one else to provide for her. And so she goes to the task. And the man in whose field she labors is a man of enormous character. You've got to remember that this took place in the time of the judges. Some think that it might have been during the period of Gideon, because during the time that Gideon was judged, the Midianites were creating such havoc in the land that Gideon had to thresh his grain in secret because they were coming in and robbing them of everything they could get. That may have been the reason for the famine. That's just a speculation. But at any rate, it was a black time morally in the nation of Israel, because the book of Judges is described as being a period when there was no king in Israel and every man did what was right in his own eyes, and what was right in their eyes was usually wrong. It was a period of tragedy because they would do these ungodly things, and then they'd be turned over to the enemies by the Lord, and in their trouble and distress because their enemies, they'd cry out for mercy to God again. Remember that the Lord was their God, and then he would deliver them by sending a judge. And then after they were delivered, they would forget. Didn't take long to forget, and they'd be back at the same old corner doing the same old ungodliness. Does that remind you of anything? You know how we are. We'll cry to the Lord in our distress for mercy and for relief. But when we get it, when everything is all right again, we think we did it, and we think we're taking care of it, and God gets pushed out of the picture, and we're back doing the same nonsense all over again. And I want to tell you that that's wickedness, and it's stupidity. And there was a lot of stupidity in Israel during this time. If you read the 17th, 18th, 19th chapters of the book of Judges, you read about some awful things. And some of them took place in connection with Bethlehem. You read about a man whose concubine was ravaged to death by the citizens of the city of Ephraim. He went out in the morning to find her lying lifeless at the threshold of the door of the home where he was staying. He was a man from Bethlehem, or she was from Bethlehem. And it's gruesome. He took her corpse and cut it into 12 pieces and sent it throughout Israel. And by that stirred up the wrath even of these people who had gone into such dark iniquity. And they came against the people of Benjamin, and after having paid a heavy price themselves that I judge be God's punishment for them, finally Judah paid the penalty in the battle that ensued. Terrible time. Awful wickedness, idolatry everywhere, and the people didn't care about God. Now, what this story of Ruth tells you is that even in the darkest night, there's some light that's shining. And that it doesn't make any difference how bad a time is and how wicked the people become around us. We can do what's right. Ruth is a Gentile. She has no background. There is nothing in her life that would have moved her to go in this direction except her honesty, except her integrity, except her desire, her will to do what was good. And I think you can say the same thing about Elimelech and Naomi, that these are godly people and their sons in the midst of all this hellishness. Now, you and I think that we're living, and we're not too far, I suppose, wrong in our estimate, in a hellish time in this country. Immoral, wicked, uncaring. It's one thing to be immoral and ashamed. It's another thing to be immoral and unashamed. We are immoral, ungodly, and we're not ashamed. We fly it as the flag of our freedom and our sophistication. We revel in it. And it's not good. It's not a good time. But nothing about the circumstance in which we live, if we love God, and if our commitment has any kind of similarity, the kind of commitment that Ruth expresses to Naomi, no reason in the world why we can't live godly lives and rear godly children. Absolutely no reason whatsoever. And so, this is sort of an oasis in a godless time. This couple, Elimelech and Naomi, this Moabite woman, Ruth, and this godly, wealthy man. Amazing contradiction in some ways, you know. The wealthy usually are indulgent. They are selfish. They are unconcerned about other people. It's so obvious as you see this man come into the field that he's concerned about his workers, that he has a relationship with them that is godly. His greeting to them, I think, is striking. He said, "The Lord be with you." And they reply quickly, "And the Lord bless you." I dare say that there are plenty of employees in our world that would not ever hear from the employer, "The Lord bless you." And I'll tell you for sure, the employer will not hear from the employees, "And the Lord bless you." Not going to happen. But in this case, it happened. But it was the character of the owner of the land, character of the farmer, that made that happen. And then he notices Ruth. Now, it may be our conclusion that he notices Ruth because she's a young lady of some striking features, and that he's wondering who the new girl is in the field. But probably the greater likelihood is that he was familiar with who came to his fields, that he was aware of people, and he did not know her. And so he asked his servant who she was. And he tells Boaz who she is. He's that Moabite. No name, you know. That Moabite girl that came back from Moab with Naomi, she's been out here working in the fields, just took a little time off to go to the house, and that's it. She'd been working all day. And then Boaz comes to her in verse 8 and says, "Listen to me. Don't glean in any other field. You just stay right here, and you stay close by my own maidservants. And then you just reap." And then he said, I've given instruction to the young men not to touch you." Well, maybe he had. If he had, we don't know anything about it. He just found out about her. And if he's given this instruction, it's not known. And maybe he just saying, "That's what I'm going to do." But at any rate, he makes special provision and says, "You drink whenever you need a drink with the young men, the water the young men have drawn." And she falls on her face and she says, Why have you treated me so kindly?" And he said, "Because I've learned what you have done for Naomi." She is a Moabitess, enemy of Israel, pagan society. But Boaz recognizes character and the special nature of her character. Love for her mother-in-law, to whom she owed nothing. Coming to Israel, where she was likely to find nothing. Indeed, to be a gleaner in the field as one of the poor is not exactly a world-shaking circumstance to be in. And he said, I heard how you left your father and your mother and the land of your nativity and came to a people that you did not know before. Then look at verse 12. Now this may in some ways be a thematic statement, the book of Ruth. The Lord recompense your work, and a full reward be given you of the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you are come to take refuge. Those are wonderful words too. In many ways, they rival the words of Ruth to Naomi. Don't ask me to leave you or to go back. I'm not going to do it. And now he says, you have taken refuge under the wings of the Lord. And by the way, the name used here always is not the Hebrew Elohim, which is the general word for God, but it's that covenant name of the Lord that was special to Israel, Jehovah, Yahweh. And then she said in verse 13, let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for that you have comforted me, and for that you have spoken kindly to your handmaid, though I be not as one of your handmaidens. It meant something to Ruth, who was a stranger here, working, doing the best she could to achieve what needed to be achieved. Somebody cared and spoke kindly. I want to say this to all of you. We need to learn to speak kindly to people. Sometimes all we offer them, I'm afraid, and I've been as guilty as anyone, is indifference. There are people who are having a difficult time, and we don't know about that. A word of kindness, of thoughtfulness, could absolutely redirect their lives. Make tremendous change. He was a man sensitive to people. And she deeply appreciated it. And when time came for the workers to eat, she said, Boaz said, come sit at my table here. Now this thing has taken on a little more than kindness, it seems to me, by this time. You come sit here and you dip right in with me. She sat with the reapers. And then when she was finished eating and ready to go back to work, you notice Boaz said to the young men, he said, now you fellas just drop a few sheaves along the way. You just pay no attention to that. You be sure that she gets something to collect. And she did. She got a whole bushel full of barley. I don't know. I picked a little cotton in my day. And that stuff never weighs much of anything. I know when you drag that sack through the field, get your hands all cut up on the bowls, and then you bring it in. It just seems like cotton weighs so little when they put that on the scale after all that work you did. But you think about a bushel of grain. I mean, after it's threshed, after it's beaten out the grain, you got a bushel. And that's a pretty good size amount of grain for anybody to have gathered. And not only that, but when she was eating lunch, she did what? She took some of it and put it in her pocket. And when she got home, she brought it out to give to Naomi. She was thinking about Naomi and what she'd have need of. And then she also presented the grain. But she did just exactly like Boaz said. And so now we come to the third scene that we've already introduced of the return of Ruth to Naomi's home. And she has got to get all the news. Where did you spend your day? And so she tells her, well, it was in this place where a man named Boaz was reaping, or was the owner of the field. And so as a consequence of that, Naomi says, oh, blessed be God. That's one of my husband's relatives. And then now we have the instruction. My daughter, shall I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? And now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maidens you were? Behold, he winnows barley tonight in the threshing floor. Tonight they're going to be threshing the barley. So you go and you lie down at his feet and cover your feet with his cloth there. Now this has been a source of a lot of consternation. What is this young widow doing down there sleeping with this man. And I don't think there's anything untoward about it. I don't think Naomi would have even suggested. Naomi was a woman of great virtue. And so was Ruth. And nothing like this would have been done if there was anything untoward about it. What is being done here is she is being encouraged to go and say, "Will you take me as your wife?" So that children can be raised up to whom? To Elimelech and Naomi. Because she has no sons. There will be no children. This is the widow of her son. And there was a Levirate law, and we're not absolutely sure that this is in play here, but it may well be. There was a Levirate law that's mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 25 that said if your brother dies and has no children, that you are to take the widow, the brother is to take the widow and raise up children to his brother. The first child would become his brother's child, his brother's seed. And at least the implication is that that's being done here. That is to be done here. A near relative, at least in this case, is to take her as his wife so that there will be seed for Elimelech. And so she goes and does as her mother tells her to do. And in the middle of the night, he grew a little restless, was startled by something, wakes up and finds this strange woman lying. I mean, he doesn't know who she is, lying at his feet. And says in verse 9, "Who are you?" And she said, "I'm Ruth, your handmaid. Spread therefore your skirt over your handmaid, for you are a near kinsman." The obvious statement is made. I'm asking you to take me as your wife. And he said, and this tells me that Boaz has been thinking a little about this. That this wasn't a sudden revelation to him, and it wasn't something that he looks on with disfavor. He said, "Blessed be thou of Jehovah, my daughter. You have showed more kindness in the latter end than at the beginning, inasmuch as you followed not young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do to you all that you have said, for all the city of my people doth know that you are a worthy woman." Now, notice that. Notice that. Everybody in town could have suspected her. She was a Moabitess. We all know what Moabites do. We know the kind of background she came from. And yet, as a consequence of her behavior in this city for a brief time, everybody knew. Perhaps from the testimony of Naomi. But everybody knew she was a worthy, a virtuous woman. Let me say this to every woman in this audience. You need to live so that everyone who truly knows you will say, "This is a virtuous woman." They will know it by your demeanor. They will know it by your behavior. They will know it by your principles. They will know it by your values. They will know it by your dress. They will know it by everything about you. That there is nothing carnal. There is nothing light. There is nothing shallow about this person. And so Ruth was known. And it's obvious that Boaz is delighted at the prospect of having her for his wife. He says, "Only one problem. There's another kinsman that's nearer than I am. But I'll take care of that." So she lay at his feet until the morning and rose up before anybody could recognize her. And he instructed everybody not to say anything about it. Sent her home with what's described as 6 something of barley. The New King James Version says ephahs, but an ephah is a bushel. And the idea that Boaz put 6 bushels of barley grain on the back of this girl and sent her home is a little bit more than I just can't envision that. And therefore, I like the American Standard Version, which just puts measures in there and it's added. But so also is the ephah. That's also added in the New King James Version. And sends her home. It's obvious he's saying, "This is going to be worked out. We're going to do exactly what you have requested." And so now the fourth scene and the conclusion of the book of Ruth. Naomi says to Ruth when she gets home, said, "You just be quiet because he'll take care of it." And maybe it's obvious to him that he's rather taken with Ruth and that he's going to move on this thing. And so next day at the city gate, you know, that's where all the politics of the city were discussed. Where it was done, it was the place where judgment was given, and he selects about 10 of the elders of the city and brings them here to be witnesses, and then he speaks to his relative, his kinsman, said, "Come here, we've got business to transact," and he said, "Now, I want to tell you that Naomi is back, and she's got a field she has sold, or is to sell, and it's for you as the near kinsman to buy to redeem that field. Will you do that? He said, oh, be glad to. Be glad to. Oh, he said, one other thing. He said, whoever redeems the field has got to take Ruth the Moabitess as his wife. Oh, he said, that's another thing. Because that's a problem. He said, I've got this problem with my inheritance, and I can't do that. It would just mess up everything. And perhaps Boaz knew that'd be the case. And so the man takes off his shoe, as was the custom in Israel, and gives it to Boaz, which then means you can put your foot on it now. You can take that for yourself. I give it to you. And so you redeem it. And so then said Boaz, verse 5, what day you buy the field of the hand of Naomi, you buy it also. Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. And the near kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar my own inheritance. Take you my right of redemption on you, for I cannot redeem it. And so Boaz does that. Verse 8, so the near kinsman said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. And he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said to the elders and to all the people, you are witnesses this day that I bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Okay. Now look at verse 11. And the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come to your house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and do you worthily in Ephrathah, and be famous in Bethlehem, and let your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bare to Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give thee of this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. What's this book all about? Well, it's a wonderful story about people of character in the midst of an unholy time. It's a wonderful story about how people who trust God, even though they're empty, they're going to be made full. Because the story is finished with a little genealogy. Verse 18. Now, these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nahshon, and Nahshon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. This is the great-grandmother of David. This is the great-grandmother of David. It could not have been written before David's time. Some have thought it was written well after David's time. But most conservative scholars believe it was written perhaps in the early period of the monarchy of David, the reign of David. Some think that Samuel, that Jewish tradition says Samuel wrote it, but of course Samuel died before David ever became king, but he had anointed him king to be king over Israel 10 years before he ever became king, and he would have known that he was going to become king, and so it's possible that Samuel might have written this along with the book of Judges, as some believe, but we don't need to be dogmatic about it. But the point of it all is that this story is a story of greatness. It's a story of greatness of the history of the line of David. And it's about something that happened in Bethlehem, down under the rock where Bethlehem was seated, and with the fields where shepherds were, and they kept their flocks, and where the fields were that the grain was raised. And later on, the light of God supernal was to light upon this very place, and shepherds were to hear the voice of angels sing. And the son of David was born in the city of Bethlehem. It was announced that he was born that day. Wonderful scenes before him of David. I want to take you just briefly, and then we end the lesson, to the first chapter of Matthew. And the genealogy of Christ. According to this genealogy, you know who Boaz's mother was? Verse 5, and Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab. Someone says, a lot of different Rahabs. I know that, but there are only four women mentioned in this whole genealogy, and women were not even usually mentioned. The first is Tamar, who begat children to Judah in fornication. The second is Salmon, who begat Boaz of Rahab, and Rahab was a harlot in the city of Jericho, who befriended the spies sent there, and by faith Rahab, says the 11th chapter of Hebrews. By faith Rahab the harlot. And that Boaz begat Obed of Ruth, a Moabitess, a Gentile. And the fourth is in verse 6, toward the end, David begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. Interesting family tree, isn't it? God is able to do great things out of activities that seem inconsequential. I'm going to leave you with this thought, all you women, and the men as well. You may think that your daily tasks are not going to mean anything. You may believe that your loyalty and your devotion are going at last to just be poured out like water on the sand without consequence. But if you trust God, if you trust God and do what you do with love and devotion and loyalty and faithfulness and virtue, you will be used to accomplish great good in your own times and in the times to come that you can only envision by faith. So Ruth, the little Moabite girl, became the grandmother of David, who became the ancestor of the King of the world, who has blessed us all. You be faithful. You be true as she was. And so you will bless others. If you're not a Christian, you're throwing your life away. I don't care how good it looks. No good is going to come of it, either for you or for those who are going to be influenced by it. For the path you are taking is the path that others are being influenced into. And don't ever question that. If you don't want everybody to follow the direction you're taking, then get out of it. Because less knowledgeable and less sophisticated souls are running right behind you to do what you are doing. You need to make a change. But if you'll trust God, I don't care how bleak the prospect, I don't care how difficult the day, you are going to be a blessing and you're going to be blessed. That's the promise of God. The story of Ruth tells it in powerful fashion. And we want to leave that with you today and urge you to come and serve the Lord, to be baptized into Christ on the basis of a faith that says, I will follow you wherever you go. On a basis of faith that says in the language of Ruth, don't ask me to turn away from you. I will not leave you. Wherever you go, that's where I'm going to go. Wherever you live, that's where I'm going to live. Your God will be my God, and your people my people. Won't you do that now while we're standing and singing?